Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Well, we're very happy with this deal here with Alex and Justin Wilson. The two players we've got, you know, we target them. And Candelario, we have an advanced player already playing AAA with a little bit of a major league experience. We feel very good about. He's in the top 100. They're number one prospect. And with Zach Paredes, we got a guy that, quite frankly, might be even higher rated than Candelario coming into this winter. He's a young player. He's just a little around 18 years old, really playing A-ball and doing very well. So as far as age appropriate, actually at where he's at right now. Well, we had several teams that really liked him, and like I've always said, you know, out of the 30 clubs in Major League Baseball, I'm sure everybody would like to have a Justin Wilson in their bullpen. However, at the end of the day, you know, you start chipping away, and you really get down to the nitty-gritty of the few teams that really had that kind of interest and that would be willing to really trade a couple of good prospects in return, and Chicago at the end really stepped up. For a long time now, we've had a big void in our system of young prospects coming through this, you know, coming through that we can count on for the future. We felt this was a good opportunity to stock up.
You know, he brings a lot of experience pitching in the back end of games. So what we'd like to do is leverage him against the right-hand hitters. Can take a little bit of the load off of guys like Brian Shaw. He's not going to replace anybody. But with his experience, his ability to, with the deception and stuff, especially against righties, believe me, we'll use him. You know, having him before, knowing what kind of teammate he is, what kind of guy he is, it's really welcome. I mean, Chris and I talked about this a lot. Not just trying to add, but adding guys that fit and not only don't disrupt, but build on what you're doing. I think Smitty checks all the boxes and more.
He's perfect for Yankee Stadium because he keeps the ball down in the strike zone. He's been throwing a great changeup of late, and he's perfect for the Yankees not only for this year, but also for 2018, 2019, because he's under team control then. That's what the Yankees weren't really interested in paying for in a guy like Darvish, Rental. They needed someone who was going to hold over to be part of their staff next year after CeCe Sabathia, Michael Pineda, others move on. I love what the Nationals did because they had a clear hole at the back end of their bullpen, and Mike Rizzo, their general manager, did a great job of trying to plug that over, pay for that over. We don't know if it's going to work, but you love the effort. They went out and added Sean Doolittle, Ryan Madsen, Brandon Kinsler was added in a deal just before the trade deadline yesterday, the closer from the Twins. So now Dusty Baker has a lot of options.
And I think this is another sign that the Dodgers are really going for it. It breaks from tradition with this new group here. They do not trade prospects to get rental pieces, but they did this because it's Yu Darvish. And look, I know there are issues. How does he throw when he's not feeling very well? I know he's got an ERA over 7 in July, but my guess is, and you guys are going to argue with me, that when the playoffs roll around, they're going to open with Clayton Kershaw and follow him with Yu Darvish.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
It is indeed the extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5, where we are, Toledo's sports leader. Thanks so much for being with us right here. My goodness, on the ticket, a lot of stuff in that montage to talk about. A lot of important things happened yesterday that are going to affect a lot of games and seasons to come for the Detroit Tigers. You heard a lot of Al Avila there. Not so much for the Indians because they didn't do quite as much. Then some baseball experts, Buster Olney and Tim Kirkchen, on some of the moves that were made at the deadline. All of that to talk about today, as well as some NFL news from training camps, including the Lions. Matthew Stafford said to be with a substantial gap to be closed between himself, his agent, and the Lions before they can finalize any sort of a long-term contract agreement. Quite a gap in money, apparently, is where we are. I didn't think it was really going to be that difficult, considering just where we are in the system and the way things have played out with the likes of Derek Carr, Kirk Cousins, still looking for his long-term deal, but, of course, being a twice-franchise player. A lot of stuff goes into that mix. We'll talk about that. Did the Tigers do enough at the trading deadline to reconstruct and rebuild a contending team in the next couple or 3 years. A lot of media folks in Detroit say no, they really didn't. They really did not do enough. One Detroit writer called Tigers' moves enough to get off to a halting start of the rebuild. That's a problem. You want to get off to a roaring start. You want to get off to a fast start. You want to get some great young players in the system that you know are going to be good, that you're just going to be, have to be patient with and make happen in time. But a halting start is not a good thing. Halting start means you're kind of like a little off to a little stumble here. Did we really get enough of the kind of pieces that we need? So we're going to talk about that. Another one essentially declared that the Tigers needed more of a daring reconstruction plan. Really daring, really risky. Did they do enough about that? And the answer, of course, would be no. So we got a lot of that to get into. Got some NFL, as you mentioned, on Matthew Stafford. Odell Beckham Jr. wants to be the highest paid player in the entire game. A wide receiver, can that be possible? No, it should not be possible. I suppose it can be, but it should not be. We're going to talk a little bit about that. What else do we have going on? Basketball-wise, we know there is still the ongoing Kyrie Irving watch. Where is he going to go? How come he has not had a firm deal offered? I guess the Cavaliers have heard from a number of teams with offers, but obviously not the one that the Cavaliers are looking for. So we'll talk a little bit about that. There's another basketball note. Oh, yeah! Michael Jordan responding to the mouth that roared. The great MJ, the GOAT. The man whose Jumpman logo should be the new basketball logo, replacing the logo that is Jerry West. MJ responding to taunts from LeVar Ball, who continues to say that he could have beaten Jordan in one-on-one and said he still could. Michael Jordan responds with one of the greatest lines of all time. He would beat LeVar Ball in a game of one-on-one if he was one-legged. One leg is all it would take, and he would still beat LeVar Ball. Oh my, now it's getting real. And oh, by the way, LeVar Ball continuing to embarrass himself and continuing to drive away some supporters who were really interested in backing him up and now who feel as though he is taking things just a little bit too far. His misogyny, his anti-woman, we saw what he did to a female reporter/anchor on a talk show about a month and a half ago. And now he has doubled down, of course, with his assault of a female referee. Not physical, of course, but a verbal assault on a female referee. His misogyny is working for him. He's actually using it to sell T-shirts. We're going to talk a little bit about the wild, strange world of LeVar Ball as well. All right, so a lot of... Oh, and you know what? Let me get to one other NFL thing, too, because this one, in fact, I don't know. Maybe this is the right place to start rather than finish with. It isn't often you have a current active NFL player acknowledging that he is so devoted to his sport and he is so unconcerned with the potential dangers of his sport that even if the worst thing had happened in his sport, dying on the field, he would be okay with it. Jamal Adams has said, if I had a perfect place to die, I would die on the field. And he is drawing a lot of attention and a lot of criticism from a lot of circles for that comment. So we're going to get into that a little bit as well. So thanks so much for being with us. Jim Cushland is here with us as well. Mr. Cushland, everybody give Jim a big round of applause, please.
Oh, come on, guys. Oh, you're killing me, Smalls.
That's a little harsh. Cushland, is it true you're not going to be here tomorrow?
That is true.
Why? What the heck's going on? How come you're not going to be here tomorrow?
That is true. It's the little one's birthday. Yeah. So we're all... Yeah. Thanks, guys. Okay, I get it now.
I don't know if that cheering is for your little one's birthday or the fact that you're not going to be here tomorrow.
I have a feeling it's the latter. Yeah, but I don't, it was the former.
I don't really know about that. Anyway, Kush, welcome as always. All right, we're going to start. I got so many different places to start. I kind of want to start with baseball. I kind of want to start with football. I kind of want to start with basketball. But let's go ahead and start with this last football story.
All right.
I just brought it up. Jamal Adams is indeed drawing a lot of criticism, as I mentioned. People are not really thrilled with his idea of, you know, especially after the report that just came out, 99% of the players' brains that were tested did show signs of CTE. That's a problem, as I discussed very, very in-depthly last week. It's a story that, you know, it's a closed study. It's a study of brains of only people whose, you know, brains were donated by science, by their to science by the families of people who saw symptoms of brain damage. They saw symptoms and said, I want to check this. And a whole bunch of people find symptoms of brain damage. Guess what you're going to find in those brains? You're going to find brain damage. So it's a closed study. It is certainly not, or it should not be seen as an indictment of football, but it is still enough to have a lot of people nervous. It was enough to have one really, really smart player last week essentially announce his retirement, saying that he just doesn't want to mess around. Now, he's looking for his doctorate from MIT. He is a brilliant, brilliant dude. He's a mathematician who just feels like he doesn't want to have anything happen that could, you know, impact his future as far as that career. But this is a little bit out there. It was an awkward moment compounded by an odd reaction from the audience described by CNN. Roger Goodell conducting a fan forum Monday in the New York Jets auditorium flanked by Matt Forte and Jamal Adams. About 150 season ticket holders in the room asking questions. Somebody asked about CTE. And Jamal Adams said, you know what? I'm not a big fan of the rules that protect offensive players, and I'm not worried about what happens to me on the field. As a matter of fact, if that's how my life had to end, he'd be perfectly fine with
it. I'm all about making the game safer, but as a defensive player, you know, I'm not a big fan of it, but I get it. But, you know, again, you know, I can speak for a lot of guys that play the game. You know, we live and breathe, and this is what we're so passionate about. Literally, if I had a perfect place to die, I would die on the field. I would be at peace. Literally, I would be at peace, and that's not a lie. Like, it's so much sacrifice that we go through as a team, and just connecting as one and winning ball games. It's nothing like playing the game of football. But again, I'm all about making the game safer. That's all I can say about it.
I'm all about making the game safer, but safe or not safe, if I had a place to die, my perfect place would be on the field. I'm all about that. I'm all about that life. That's where I am. Strangely enough, Jim Cushlin, it wasn't the oddest sound that we heard from that little press conference. Because to me, what was stranger, what was more awkward, was the fact that the 150 or so Jets season ticket holders applauded when he said that.
I would be at peace. Literally. I would be at peace. And that's not a lie.
Dude just said, I would die on the field for my sport. Yeah! Woo! Death! Yeah! Dead players on the field. I'm all about it, man. I feel you, dog. Yeah! What? That was odd.
Literally, if I had a perfect place to die, I would die on the field. I would
Woo!
Be at peace.
Grim Reaper in a helmet. Yeah.
That's not a lie. Like, it's so much sacrifice that we go through as a team, and just connecting as one and winning ball games.
I understand his point. I truly do.
Yeah.
I know what he means. You ever hear, Jim, how many times have we heard the old euphemism? The old
cliche. Oh, yeah.
Leaving it all on the field. I didn't take anything off the field with me. I left it all out there. Everything I had. All of my heart, all of my soul. People talk about that all the time.
Yep.
But do they really mean it? Do they really mean I would be willing to die playing the game that I love? Now, some might say there are a lot of people who feel like their best end to this life on this earth would be doing what they love. If you died in the course of doing what you love, that you can't really ask for much more than that. A lot of people would say that. It's kind of it's an odd thing to say, and it's an odd thing to really kind of wrap your brain around, but I understand the point. This is, if I've got to go, which I never want to do, but we all do, why not go in the course of doing something that was perfectly enjoyable to me, as opposed to suffering in a terrible way, you know, maybe dying a slow death, a painful death, something in which your family watches you deteriorate, that sort of thing. I'd rather die, you know, doing something that I love and have it happen in such a way. I get that. But it's just weird for him to say in the middle of, you know, people concerned about, you know, the health of players, for him to say, especially with two things. Number one, the fans cheered it. Number two, Roger Goodell, the man who's responsible for making sure players don't die on the field. the guy who's responsible for answering all of the critics about the dangers of football, and this is why you don't have to be afraid of it, for him to sit there right next to him and say, man, that's a perfect place for me to die. That was just a very, very odd circumstance.
Yeah, it's obviously something, you know, you don't expect to hear. And at the same time, though, I'm with you. The whole time I'm listening to that, I'm hearing that euphemism, that version of it anyway, at least in this case. And, you know, if anyone's going to try to say, well, what about those idiot fans who are clapping about a guy dying on the field? No, I think they get it, too, in the context of, hey, look, this is the, to me, that would be the ultimate leaving it all in line. That's most of the time what fans want. You know, what's one of the things you hate as a fan? Here's one example. The guy doesn't, you know, run that ground ball out. Just one little example as first thing that popped in my head. Fans hate that. They like to know that you, the player, are willing to leave it all out there, so to speak.
Right. But on the flip side, if they knew that as soon as you tag first base, you know, that there's a landmine under it, and I'm going to run that out, and I'm going to die on this play, I might not be in such a hurry to do that.
Right.
That's the weird thing about it. And nobody is thinking about dying when they're playing football.
No,
and I understand
of course
Jamal
not.
Adams doesn't either. He was just trying to make a point.
Right.
He was just trying to say that, look, it's a violent game. It's always going to be a violent game. I am for player safety. On the other hand, I wish they would let us continue to do what we signed up to do, and that's play football, which is hard-hitting, teeth-chattering, rib-cracking, rock-solid hits on guys, the way it used to be back when the NFL actually, you know, produced highlight videos featuring the biggest, hardest hits. NFL crunch time videos made them millions. You know, the Sports Center, as little as 10, 12, 15 years ago, I don't even know if it was that long, Jim, contained a segment of Sports Center called Jacked Up. And they would show the biggest, hardest hits in which somebody got leveled, and they would all get together, and he got, and everybody in the studio would yell, Jacked Up! They're jacking guys, and that's what they signed up to play.
That's right.
And that's what nobody realized. None of these guys are victims. None of these guys are out there against their free will. Nobody's put a gun to their head and say, go do this for a living.
And nobody
actually
wants
to die.
They know
what they're playing, and they want to play it, and they want to play it as violently as, you know, as they ever have.
Yeah, and nobody actually wants to die on the field. I mean, again, that, you know, that was a euphemism, for example, that I fully understood as he was saying it. So,
yeah, well, I mean, it would be impossible not to. I mean, come on. I mean, that's the most obvious thing ever.
Exactly.
His point is we want the game to be violent.
Right.
We want the game to be hard hitting. We want the game to be, the way that it used to be. And they sign up for it. It would be kind of like, you know, MMA. Did you see the Cormier fight? Did you see Bones Jones knock out of Daniel Cormier, who now has two losses on his professional fighting record, MMA fighting record? Both of them to John Bones Jones. He's a legend. They're both legends. Daniel Cormier got jacked up. He took a kick to the head, then a knee to the head, then he fell to the ground and countless numbers of blows to the head.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was vicious. It's the kind of thing that one might say might dare cause a concussion. And it's the kind of thing that if you have multiple concussions, it might lead to CTE and brain damage. And guess what? Daniel Cormier knows that. Anyone in there anyway. Everybody knows that. And they go in there anyway. They know that they could get knocked unconscious. They could have concussions and then some with lingering side effects in the short term and in the long term. But they don't want to make the boxers or the MMA fighters wear those great big giant inflatable fists that we used to have when we were kids, when we would do our little in living room boxing matches. You know, those great big things that blew up to be the size of small TV sets. You know what I'm talking about?
I do kind of remember that.
Remember those? They were different colors?
Yeah.
And they're not, you know, they don't want them to do that to make it safer. They're saying, look, this is what I love to do. I love to punch. I love to kick. I love to get kicked, but I'm willing to get kicked in order to do what I do here. And if it costs me my life, as sad as it is to say, I would be okay with that because I made the decision that's right for me. To pursue a very, very violent sport that could lead to either long-term health problems or maybe even a short-term, you know, situation, a death. And we've seen deaths on the field. We have to, not in the NFL. We've seen death on the court. basketball court in the middle of a game, you know, a guy like Hank Gathers.
Yeah.
We've seen deaths happen from direct action on the field in Ray Chapman.
Yeah.
And we have seen, you know, we've seen guys get paralyzed from the neck down in the National Football League.
Oh yeah.
Mark Utley.
I remember that.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
Detroit fans will all know very well. And others. So I find it very interesting what Jamal Adams had to say. Here was Stephen A. Smith's response to Jamal Adams today saying that he would die on the field, just to kind of get another perspective on this.
Take a look at these tweets from Martellus Bennett.
Yes.
Tweeted this out yesterday, and here's what he tweeted. I hope all these young cats that are willing to die for the game of football find a higher purpose in life. Look, football is great, but I ain't dying for this blank. LOL.
Yeah.
Okay, so do you think...
And I'm going to stop there and just give my own response to that before I listen to the response from Stephen A. Smith on SportsCenter. Martellus Bennett is lying. Okay? Martellus Bennett is lying. He said, football is great, but I ain't dying for this blank. But you are, Martellus. You are a violent player, delivering and receiving violent hits, things that very well could take your life in the long run. You may have a much shorter lifespan because of football. You also may cause somebody else to have a shorter lifespan because of football. You also may be in an unfortunate situation like Daryl Stingley or Mike Utley, be in a situation where you are paralyzed from the neck down and your life is pretty much given for this. It just hasn't happened to you yet. It's easy to say. What Jamal Adams at least is saying is, I know that it can. And if it does, he's saying, I will have no regrets. Now, it should be pointed out, and I think Booger McFarland was the one who pointed it out best this morning, if you're listening. I think it was Booger, who said, remember, this is a young dude, Jamal Adams. He's not married. He doesn't have kids, so he doesn't have a family relying upon him. If and when he does get married and has his own children, chances that he might think a little bit differently about the, hey, I would die. If I died on the field, I'd be perfectly happy thing. He might think differently about that. But for now, as a young man, where he's pretty much responsible for only himself, this is how he feels. And I think all he's doing is acknowledging the obvious, that of course nobody wants to die on the field, but if I play a violent sport, I recognize that is the potential, either directly on the field from a hit or indirectly from a shorter lifespan because of a series of hits taken and given over the course of my career. But
here's in the NFL right now feel more like Adams, or do they feel more like Bennett?
I think the younger players feel more like Adams. I think the older players feel more like Martellus Bennett. He didn't say anything wrong. He's absolutely right. There is a higher purpose. There's a lot that you have to offer to the game of life than just football. There's no question about that. Nobody's saying that Jamal Adams was right in what he's saying. What we're saying is that when you're young and you have this passion for the game of football, you understand how words like that can come out of the mouth of a youth who basically is a puppy. You've barely lived yet. You've got your whole life ahead of you, but you don't see the forest from the trees. That comes with age and experience and attrition. And Martellus Bennett is a more experienced soul, more wiser, more knowledgeable. So he would know, and he's right to send out the tweet that he sent out, because it's reminding the youngsters that there's more to life than this. But in the same breath, you still understand what comes with it. All the sacrifices you make as a youngster, all with it, with the goal in mind, the aim to make the NFL. This is what you're living for all your life. And in your mind, you've practically died for it, crying out loud, with what you put yourself through.
Boom.
In order to get to that level. So again,
that is exactly right, too. And I want to point that out, too. Look at the physiques of the average NFL player, whether it's a Martellus Bennett on the defensive line or Jamal Adams in the secondary. Look at their physiques. They don't spend thousands of hours in the weight room lifting and getting stronger and getting harder, getting faster, so that they can hit softer. They don't spend their lives getting bigger, stronger, harder, and faster so that they can hit a little bit lighter the next time around. It's so that when they hit, the other guy feels it worse than they do. I'm going to have to commit an act of violence with my body on somebody else's body on every play. And as I do it, I know that I could be causing great damage to myself, and so therefore I'm going to try to cause more damage to him. Because he is going to try to cause more damage to me than he does to himself. That's what Jamal Adams means when he says, I'm willing to do whatever it takes. Literally, if I had the perfect place to die, I would die on the field. He doesn't really mean I want to die playing football, but he's playing a violent game. He gets his body as hard as he can get it so that his violent act is going to be better than the other guy's violent act. So if something does happen, it's going to be to the other guy. And he knows that that possibility exists. And I think it's very, very important for everybody to understand that.
And Martellus Bennett is not wrong by any stretch of the imagination. It's just that when you're Jamal Adams and you're so young, you can understand where something like that comes from. And he's to be educated, yep, but he's not to be insulted and denigrated for what he said, because he meant no harm by it. He was just speaking to the passion that he feels for a game he loves.
And I think that's exactly right. I think Stephen A. said it exactly right, and I'm really glad to see people understanding it. Okay, here's what I got. Got a timeout here after we check out on our stat of the day.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents The Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
Buffalo Wild Wings Stat of the Day. Now that July is over, it's time to see, did Jose Altuve get there or not? The Astros All-Star was on a pace to have a .500 batting average for an entire season, a month of the season, joining some very elite company we talked about previously. But he fell just a little bit short. Still, here are Jose Altuve's wild stats from the month of July. An amazing .485 in the month is where he ended up, going 48 for 92 with 10 doubles, 4 homers, 21 driven in, and 8 stolen bases in 23 games. So not quite .500, but an amazing month. All the same, Jose Altuve's batting average now .368 on the season, 12 points higher than anybody else in baseball. So there you go. Thanks to Jose Altuve for providing us with our Buffalo Wild Wings wild stat of the day. Okay, a lot more to get into, a lot more football, basketball, baseball coming your way. We're going to talk with Chris Cotillo coming up in about a half an hour or so, a little bit after 4 o'clock after the montage. We're going to talk about all of the trades that went down yesterday. Pretty much everybody nationally agreeing with what Jim and I said yesterday on this program. We have kind of been set up for the ultimate showdown in the World Series that so many people remember back from the days of yore. Back in the late 1970s, when it used to be kind of a commonality to see Yankees and Dodgers in the World Series in October. New York, L.A., East Coast, West Coast, big markets, the two largest markets in the country, both got richer at the trading deadline. Both were already really, really good. Are they now in the driver's seat to face one another in October? So we'll talk about that with Chris Cotillo. But we still have a lot more ground to cover, and you can join us as well at 866-240-1065 right after this.
And so right now, by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. Rolling on the Extravaganza, it is 3:40. In about 25, 30 minutes, we're going to talk with Chris Cotillo of SBNation.com Baseball. Talk a little bit about the trading maneuvers that were made yesterday. Let's go to the Detroit. But actually, hold on a second. Let me share this, if I may. Possibly, maybe. All right, one more time. I'm just trying to
see this out yesterday, and here's what he tweeted. I hope all these young cats that are willing to die for the game of football find a higher purpose in life. Look, football is great, but I ain't dying for this blank, LOL.
Yeah.
Okay, so do you think players in the NFL right now feel more like Adams, or do they feel more like Bennett?
Jim, I wanted to share that again, this first part of that Stephen A. clip. That we
okay.
Had, because I want to tie it to the Matt Stafford. I was about to say, I'm going to go back to Matthew Stafford's story. Word out of Detroit right now is that the Lions and their star quarterback, their franchise quarterback, have a substantial gap in their negotiations. Just reading from the Detroit News and our friend Justin Rogers, the expectation has long been that the Lions and Matthew Stafford will hammer it out on an extension this offseason. But according to the NFL Network, the two sides are far apart on a potential deal. That's still a pretty, there's still a pretty substantial gap, Tom Pelissero of NFL Network wrote on Twitter. Stafford entering the final year of a three-year extension he inked in 2013. Is poised to sign the largest contract in NFL history, topping the five-year, $125 million pact recently inked by Raiders quarterback Derek Carr. Prior to the start of training camp this weekend, Stafford said that there was no timetable to get a deal done, but the sides continued to talk, If the Lions are unable to work out an extension, they would likely use the franchise tag next offseason. That would pay Stafford more than $26 million in 2018. So, okay, how do those two stories tie together? I'm wondering, Jim, when is the last time you heard an NBA player say anything even remotely close to what Jamal Adams just had to say about being willing to die on the basketball court? Can you tell me?
No, not really, now that you're making me think about this.
I don't know that I've ever heard an NBA player talking about dying on the basketball court because of the way the game is played. The NBA players are making money that makes the NFL players look like paupers. It makes somebody with a, what was Derek Carr's contract? 5 years, $125
million? 5 year, $125, and with the guarantee or not guarantee, while you continue, I'm going to look that part up.
Well, it's not guaranteed. You know, the guaranteed part is probably only the signing bonus, which is probably right around, I want to say, $40 or $50 million. We all know that Steph Curry, for example, just signed a contract for, what was it? What was the total of his 5 year contract for Steph Curry that he signed that James Harden that eclipsed just a couple of weeks after? They're signing
$201 million for Curry.
What's that?
$201 million.
$201 million for Curry. $201 million. That's $75 million more than Derek Carr. And Derek Carr is the highest paid player. What's the average? Is Steph Curry the best player in the NBA? He's a 2-time MVP, so he's up there, but he's probably not the best. The point of this is, where am I going with all this? NBA players aren't putting their lives on the line, aren't putting their brains, if you will, in terms of long-term concussion health, you know, long-term brain health because of concussions impacted by the likes of CTE, et cetera. They're not doing that. NFL players are. They're making a pittance in comparison to some of these other guys, and I'm wondering, when are the NFL players like Matt Stafford going to start holding out for numbers that do reflect that, A, we are just as big a stars as some of those guys in the NBA, but more importantly, Jim, that, B, we are taking a risk, voluntarily, yes, this is our chosen profession, but we are taking risks with our health, short and long term, that nobody else is, and we think that's got some financial value to it.
Yeah, and looking over these, and when they throw in the money part, you know, we always have to then remember that in the NFL, not all of that money is guaranteed. I'm looking at some of Derek Carr's, and guaranteed money at signing is 40 of the grand total 125.
That's what I'm talking about.
Whereas Curry, that 201, every penny of that is guaranteed.
But do you understand my point? The question I asked you, maybe you weren't listening because you were looking up stats or figures. But the question is at what point is a player like Stafford or the next guy after that, at what point is that guy going to say, not just performance-wise do I deserve X amount of dollars, but unlike the NBA guys, I'm putting my health, my long-term, and maybe even my short-term brain function on the line here. And that's got to have more value to it than a guy, for example, in an NBA uniform does or on a Major League Baseball field. You know, Giancarlo Stanton has a $325 million contract. Bryce Harper may have a $400 million contract.
Right.
Steph Curry has a $200 million contract. James Harden just signed an extension worth more average a year than Curry's is. Wait until you see what LeBron gets coming up after 2017-18 season. You know, these guys are great players. And they're being compensated for how much money they drive, how much revenue they drive for their company, which is fine. But, you know, the NFL has got to be like, we're not only driving the revenue because of how we play, but how about the fact that we have a hell of a lot more to risk here? And your, you know, life insurance and pensions that you offer us and health insurance aren't going to be enough to really make up for the fact that I may lose years of my life or I may use years of my quality life if I have to live my last 10, 12, 15, 20, 25, however long it is, years with you know, memory loss, brain damage, et cetera, et cetera. I guess I'm just wondering, at what point does Matthew Stafford's agent say, okay, now that we agree on principle because of the performance this guy will give and has given, now let's talk about how much he deserves because of what he's putting on the line. what the risk is.
And I hear where you're coming from, and this is not a new argument or anything. This has been brought up, even if it's not the health part. The concept of guaranteed versus non-guaranteed has certainly already been, you know, brought up by players. There's unfortunately, for NFL guys, there's unfortunately a couple factors that are kind of working against them a little bit that have to be fixed up a little bit. One, I venture to say that the Players Association for the NFL, the weakest of the three players unions, baseball, basketball, football, that's not helping in this situation. What is it in final cutdowns? Is it like 57 or something like that?
I mean, at the end of camp, it's 53. When they're ready 53 is all you carry.
Okay, thank you. I was off by a couple.
53 you carry, 45 active on game day.
Right. Versus 15 and 12. On an NBA roster, or 25 in baseball, and I'm not counting 40-man because most of those other 40-man guys are making AAA contracts, which is a drop in the bucket, relatively speaking. So the roster size is part of the issue here because there's just so many more guys, you know, to pay that when you add them up, you'll find a lot of NBA payrolls and NFL payrolls in terms of team payroll are very similar for a vastly more number of players. That part of that is working a little bit against NFL players. The biggest thing is whether it's a Players Association thing or somehow these agents for these players have to figure out a new way of doing this, because the gag here is if you're an NFL player, okay, maybe your contract may not be as big, but as a Curry type deal, or even an more average NBA guy. But the thing that they have to be able to do is find a way to get more of that guaranteed, and teams don't like to do that after about two years.
They can't do that. They can't do that because this is the conundrum. This is the vicious circle. I can't guarantee your contract because our game, by the nature of the violent aspect of our game, is going to lead to injuries a lot more, and I cannot afford to pay you if you are injured and unable to play. The vicious circle is the player's response is, yeah, because of the violent nature of the game, which is why I can't be guaranteed to keep playing, is why I need you to guarantee the damn deal. Because how am I supposed to earn if I'm injured playing your violent sport? So that's the irony is both sides are kind of looking at it and saying, hey, here's what I need and here's the reason why.
Yeah. Good point.
Never have I heard though an agent bring up the, hey, now that we agree on terms from a standpoint of a performance compensation, but now here's the risk compensation. This is something nobody else has to deal with. Now, you're right about the number of players. 53 on a roster versus, you know, 12 on an NBA roster, 15 maybe.
It's 15 for the full 12 right. active, kind of the right. same way with the 53 and 40-something active, same
and
principle.
And then baseball, of course, having a 25-man roster and a 40-man roster. It's a very, very different thing, obviously. And you wonder, okay, what about gate? How much money does each sport take in? In an NBA arena, an owner, you know, brings in 41, and if you are a sellout every single week, roughly 20,000 in an average NBA arena, you know, if you get 41 home dates at 20,000, look at what your ticket price to see what that generates compared to the NFL, which only has 8 of those guaranteed home gates. And even if that's at 50 or 60,000, it's still not going to add up to what 41 at 20,000 full, you know, seats, you know, would generate. Then you look at the TV contracts. We know that the TV contracts that ESPN paid for the NBA are completely outsized. And they got completely fleeced by that, by the way. And that's why the owners have much more money to spend. And there's a bigger slice of the pie that goes to the players as a part of the collective bargaining agreement.
And just by the way, real quick before you continue, that quick attendance thing that you threw out there, assume 20,000 for 41 games, that's 820,000 for the season. Assume 60,000 for 8 games, that's 480. So it's half the attendance just how it's set up.
Yeah, exactly right. And the ticket prices are more, though, so you look at that. Because there's only eight of them, they can jack up those ticket prices more at an NFL game than you can.
And everybody knows they do. This is that time of year where I'm expecting at some point this month to get the call of, why do we have to pay full price for preseason games? But I digress. That call hasn't come in yet. I'm sure it will before the month is out.
Well, yeah, I mean, as soon as people start paying it, well, and I'll bring it up if nobody does, because we'll look at the games, and we'll look at Ford Field, and we'll look out there at First Energy Field, and we're going to look at all of these empty seats, and we're and there's a reason why. And it's annoying as hell. Nobody wants to buy those at full price, and those who have to buy them at full price as part of their season ticket package have a reason to complain. No question about it, because it's just stupid. But that's part of the NFL trying to make back some of the money that they don't get for having longer home schedules in the regular season the way the other sports do. But at the end of the day, just to kind of bring this full circle to it, because we're pushing up here toward the top of the hour. You know, a guy like Jamal Adams who says, I'm willing to die on the field for this sport. This is what I love. This is the most important thing in the world to me, and if I had a perfect place to die, this is where I would die. We need to understand, number one, it's a young guy who doesn't have any family talking, and he probably feels that serious about reaching the pinnacle. I'm in the National Football League now. This is all I've ever wanted. I would die to stay here. It's probably kind of a little hyperbole on the part of a young guy. But the flip side is it's the only sport in which you have to consider, may I die or that I might die here. Well, it's the only team sport.
Right.
Which you have to consider.
I mean, you mentioned
MMA and boxing, you kind of have to consider because you get killed in the ring.
True, and that's happened in the past. But if you're thinking, you know, baseball and basketball, the couple deaths while playing are very extenuating circumstances.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, but it's since it is the only sport where you actually have to consider that.
Right.
You wonder when the compensation is going to reflect
about
that as well.
Making the game safer. But as a defensive player, you know, I'm not a big fan of it, but I get it. But, you know, again, you know, I can speak for a lot of guys that play the game. You know, we live and breathe, and this is what we're so passionate about. Literally, if I had a perfect place to die, I would die on the field. I would be at peace. Literally, I would be at peace, and that's not a lie. Like, it's so much sacrifice that we go through as a.
I can't stop just thinking about the clapping. You know, I would die on the field. Yeah, Jets fans loving that. He was a first-round pick, by the way, sixth overall in the draft was Jamal Adams. So he certainly knows how to play to the crowd. He certainly knows how to give them what they want, which is I'm going to lay it all on the line. But the truth of the matter is we can understand. And I should say this before we wrap for the hour. It always pains me to have these kinds of discussions, because I always end up having to do what I'm about to do, and that's once again rise up in defense of the sport that I love, sport that I play, not professionally, of course, but in the college. And the truth of the matter is this, and I hope every parent who's considering whether or not to let their kid play football and is nervous and worried and scared about it, I hope they're listening. Football has never been safer to play than it is right now. Do you realize that? Do you realize that 10 years ago football was more dangerous to play than it is now? 20 mm-hmm. years ago, 30 years ago, when we're talking about all those hits that we used to, you know, they used to rave about.
I always remind people, never forget how and why the face mask was invented.
Yeah, there you go.
Going way back, that's a great point, for example.
And why leather helmets went to hard plastic
shoulder helmets.
The game of football has never been safer to play than it is right now. The helmets are constantly evolving. They're constantly making improvements to protect the brain, protect the jaw, the chin. I mean, everything is better now than it has ever been. The rules have changed so that, quote-unquote, defenseless players don't take those incredibly hard shots that we were talking about that the league used to celebrate with jacked up and NFL crunch course videos and so on and so forth that they would market with. Not allowed to do that kind of hitting anymore. Targeting is a rule, which is a very controversial thing because it's only in the opinion of the referee whether or not somebody was targeting ahead with a particular shot, but you will be kicked out for that and fined, and if you do it a couple of times, you're going to be suspended for crying out loud. The league is so focused on teaching young people, and they've devoted millions of dollars to programs like heads-up tackling, which is, I think, run by USA Football, which teaches kids at the high school level, the junior high level, and even all the way down at the Pop Warner, you know, grade school levels of tackle football, how to tackle safely with the head up, keeping the head out of the contact area, using the shoulder, targeting the other person's mid, you know, shoulder, his shoulder or his midsection, not the knees, not their heads, all of the things that are being done now that were never done before. They make the NFL safer, or I should say, they make football safer to play than it's ever been before. And yet still people are freaking out over CTE studies. People are freaking out over statistics that they don't understand. And quite frankly, people are afraid of the unknown. And those who have never played the game get what I'm talking about. But the game has never been safer. And I hope everybody recognizes that going forward. No, Jamal Adams is not going to die on the field. He's just saying, I'm so passionate about what I do. This is what I love to do. And I know it's violent, and I make a choice to play a violent sport, and it's something that I would never regret. And you know what? Good for him. And I would applaud it from that standpoint, too, even though I'm not a Jets fan. Okay. Really, really heavy stuff there. We're going to lighten it up a little bit and go to baseball trades after the top of the hour, but not until I remind you about the great opportunity at our website to get your vacation ready to go. 1065theticket.com is where you can register for a $1,000 gift certificate from American Airlines. Good toward two round-trip tickets departing from Toledo Express via Charlotte, North Carolina, then on to anywhere in the continental United States. It's all from Toledo Express Airport, the Toledo Port Authority, American Airlines, and, of course, Toledo's ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Just register one time at 1065theticket.com. All right, top of the hour Sports Center coming our way. Chris Cotillo of SB Nation talking NBA or Major League Baseball trades with us on the other side right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Well, we're very happy with this deal here with Alex and Justin Wilson. The two players we've got, you know, we target them. And Candelario, we have, an advanced player already playing AAA with a little bit of a major league experience. We feel very good about. He's in the top 100. Their number one prospect. And with Zach Paredes, we got a guy that, quite frankly, might be even higher rated than Candelario coming into this winter. He's a young player. He's just a little around 18 years old, really playing A-ball and doing very well. So as far as age appropriate, excellent at where he's at right now. Well, we had several teams that really liked him. And like I've always said, you know, out of the 30 clubs in Major League Baseball, I'm sure everybody would like to have a Justin Wilson in their bullpen. However, at the end of the day, you know, you start chipping away and you really get down to the nitty-gritty of the few teams that really had that kind of interest and that would be willing to really trade a couple of good prospects in return. And Chicago at the end really stepped up. For a long time now, we've had a big void in our system of young prospects coming through this, you know, coming through that we can count on for the future. We felt this was a good opportunity to stock up.
You know, he brings a lot of experience pitching in the back end of games. So what we'd like to do is leverage him against the right-hand hitters. Can take a little bit of the load off of guys like Brian Shaw. He's not going to replace anybody. But with his experience, his ability to, with the deception and stuff, especially against righties, believe me, we'll use him. You know, having him before, knowing what kind of teammate he is, what kind of guy he is, it's really welcome. I mean, Chris and I talked about this a lot. Not just trying to add, but adding guys that fit and not only don't disrupt, but build on what you're doing. I think Smitty checks all the boxes and more.
He's perfect for Yankee Stadium because he keeps the ball down in the strike zone. He's been throwing a great changeup of late, and he's perfect for the Yankees not only for this year, but also for 2018, 2019, because he's under team control then. That's what the Yankees weren't really interested in paying for in a guy like Darvish, Rental. They needed someone who was going to hold over to be part of their staff next year after CeCe Sabathia, Michael Pineda, others move on. I love what the Nationals did because they had a clear hole at the back end of their bullpen, and Mike Rizzo, their general manager, did a great job of trying to plug that over, paper that over. We don't know if it's going to work, but you love the effort. They went out and added Sean Doolittle, Ryan Madsen, Brandon Kintzler was added in a deal just before the trade deadline yesterday, the closer from the Twins. So now Dusty Baker has a lot of options.
And I think this is another sign that the Dodgers are really going for it. It breaks from tradition with this new group here. They do not trade prospects to get rental pieces, but they did this because it's Yu Darvish. And look, I know there are issues. How does he throw when he's not feeling very well? I know he's got an ERA over 7 in July, but my guess is, and you guys are going to argue with me, that when the playoffs roll around, they're going to open with Clayton Kershaw and follow him with Yu Darvish.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed. Rolling onward into hour number two, 7 minutes after four on this Tuesday afternoon, the first day of August, the first day post-MLB trade deadline. And now, of course, all that's left, if you are a Tigers fan, is asking, did we get enough for J.D. Martinez, for Justin Wilson, for Alex Avila? Did we get enough? Should we have traded more? How quick is the rebuild going to happen? The question, if you are an Indians fan, did we do enough? All we got was Joe Smith. Helps strengthen up the bullpen a little bit, but from the wrong side. They needed a lefty reliever to get a righty reliever, and they decided to pretty much stand pat with everyone else. Is that going to be enough to keep pace with not only the Royals in division, but the Astros, who are in a little bit of a problem right now? Dallas Keuchel is still not Dallas Keuchel. You've got injuries to some very, very key guys there, but still the Astros have the best record in the league, in the American League anyway. And then the Yankees, who got way, way better at the trade deadline as well. So did they do enough? Joining us now to analyze it all from those two AL Central perspectives, as well as the rest of Major League Baseball, is Chris Cotillo, who is a Major League Baseball writer for SBNation.com. Chris, how are you?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Good. Thanks for spending some time with us. Always appreciate the opportunity. Everybody does this, and I was looking on the website. You've got at least one of your guys has winners and losers from the baseball deadline. I've got SI, Sports Illustrated's winners and losers, and I think most people's consensus, the two biggest winners are the two biggest markets, the two biggest payrolls probably that are going to be in Major League Baseball, talking about the Yankees and the Dodgers. Do you agree? Did the Yankees and Dodgers win the baseball trade deadline?
Yeah, it's tough to really do the snap judgment thing, because I think, you know, the best time to write a winners and losers of the trade deadline post is probably in like 6 years, but it obviously gets a lot of hits today, so a lot of people do it. I personally kind of like to stay away from that, just because it's something that, you know, you make all these judgments and you're probably going to be wrong at some point. So, you know, people can go back and dig it up in a couple of years and be like, oh, you're not credible anymore because you said this team won the deadline and they didn't even make the playoffs. But I think, you know, every year we see different guys really be crucial to playoff runs that, over the last few years, we've seen Yoenis Cespedes, Johnny Cueto, and Zobrist in 15 all reach the World Series after trade deadline deals. And last year we saw, you know, the two big relievers in Chapman and Miller both get there as trade deadline acquisitions and be big pieces for the Cubs and Indians down the stretch. I think, you know, obviously, this trade deadline is kind of the tale of Gray, Darvish, and Quintana going to the three big markets, and those moves each are different just because of the control. I think the Cubs getting Quintana for 3.5 years as a move, obviously that helps this year, but is really, you know, a long-term move. The same with Gray, the Yankees, and the Dodgers, you know, for the short term, really stocked up. They really went hard on Zach Britton and Brad Hand and those guys and ended up not getting any of them and Justin Wilson, and went and got Tony Watson, who was a guy that became available late. And they decided that right at the last minute they wanted to really try for Darvish one more time and get a bona fide two, who's been a one before, to pair with Kershaw. So I think that's really impressive to me that those teams were aggressive. You know, there's, when you have the money, when you have the resources, when you have the prospects, I think it's a certain, and you're 40 games over 500, I think it's time to really go for it. And they did. Both of those teams have done it. The Astros, people wanted to make more moves, but I really like, you know, those moves, and we'll see if they pay off in October and down the road.
We're talking to Chris Cotillo of SB Nation, also site manager for MLBDailyDish.com. They've got great analysis there as well of the trade deadline moves. I want to get specific, if we can, on the two teams, again, that we pay attention to here in Toledo, Ohio. To our north, it's the Tigers, of course, and to our east, it's the Indians. Tigers were sellers, did not sell everybody that they could have sold, but they did sell three important pieces. What did you make of the haul, if you can call it a haul, that they got back? They were in desperate need of a rebuild. Just looking, by the way, because I mentioned the payrolls, the Dodgers and the Yankees having the highest payrolls. As of right now, this season, $257 million the Dodgers are paying in total payroll. The Yankees, $222. The Red Sox, third at $220. Fourth are the Detroit Tigers at $205 million. Obviously not much to show for it. They had a lot of contracts they had to move, and they got to stock the farm system with some things that would been that have been robbed clean over the course of the last several trading deadlines. So what's your impression of what the Tigers were able to do at the deadline?
It's pretty, you know, it's not the worst haul we've ever seen. Candelario and Paredes, depending on on who you talk to. You know, they rate those guys differently, but both of them are really high-end guys. Candelario close to the majors. Paredes obviously far away. I think, you know, the overall deadline is kind of hampered by the weak return that they got that was kind of criticized widely for J.D. Martinez, but they were able to sell the assets we thought they would, Wilson, Martinez, and Avila, and got, you know, five guys back for them. Verlander, Kinsler, and Upton, those type guys were really hard to move before the deadline. Obviously, those didn't get done. I'm sure those things will be kind of addressed again in the offseason and continue the restocking. But they've had, you know, a couple of pretty good drafts in the last couple of years and been able to really put some guys that have really risen quickly to the top of their farm system. Alex Viedo this year is one from Florida. Matt Manning and Bo Burrows in the last couple of years have really kind of restocked that, and some guys that have done well in the minors already in just a couple of years. Funkhauser, another one. So, you know, I think the moves are just kind of not the biggest ones. Candelario is a pretty big name, but outside of that, and just to add some depth, add some pieces, and it's much needed. I think they're going to continue trying to do that in the offseason, whether it be with a Verlander deal, trying to trade some of these, you know, other pieces that they have that might have some more value and less big contracts.
Okay, you may have just partly answered the next question I was going to ask for you, and that is, were you surprised that they didn't do whatever it took to get Verlander moved at the deadline? Obviously,
no,
a huge contract, they would have had to have eaten some of that money. But I'm surprised to see a team that's going with a strong youth movement being willing to keep his $58 million and 34-year-old arm, still on the mound for
him. Yeah, I don't think it was that they were really, you know, happy with keeping him. I think it's just when you're in the situation they're in where, you know, you have your priority for the first half of the month is trading JD. That gets done, and your next priority is seeing the relief market, you know, kind of trickle down and having Wilson, and then obviously trying to trade Avila as well. And Verlander gets placed on the back burner there when teams are really prioritizing, obviously, Gray, Quintana at first, and then Gray and Darvish toward the end. Jaime Garcia, a guy that everyone was pursuing. That's why he got traded twice, I guess. But you look at Verlander, and there's just so many things that needed to get done before that was complete, whether it was figuring out how much money the team was going to pick up in terms of how much, and relating that to how many prospects they'd have to give back, and then also the no-trade clause. Those are the kind of deals that rarely get done before the trade deadline. Those are deals that sometimes happen in August, so we won't rule that out, and a lot of the time happens during the winter, you know, when you have weeks and weeks to really get the whole process and do the whole due diligence that you need to. I think it's probably, you know, a good shot that he'll be traded during the winter when they can really assess all of that. But now it's, you know, one of those things where the Justin Wilson thing went right up to the 30th. So that was their focus, and it's really hard to put everything together on deadline day with a big money deal.
We're talking to Chris Cotillo, who is a baseball writer for SBNation.com, also the site manager for MLBDailyDish.com. Let's move over to the team that is the defending league champion, the American League champions, and, of course, Central Division champion Indians. They were hoping to get a starter, maybe, to add to their rotation in the middle. They were hoping to maybe get a bat that could give them a little bit more pop because they have long stretches. And they were hoping long stretches of difficulty scoring runs, and they were hoping to get a left-handed reliever to pair with Andrew Miller because Boone Logan is out for the season. They didn't get any of the above. They got themselves another right-handed reliever, pretty good one, who's having a decent year, talking about their old friend Joe Smith, who is back. But did they do enough at the deadline to, in your mind, get back to where they were, which is to the World Series?
Yeah, I think, you know, you saw them be uncharacteristically aggressive last year at the trade deadline, and I think that heightened expectations. You know, obviously the Miller situation gets the headlines, and he's been fantastic and everything. So, and that's the big move for them last year. And then, but they were obviously had a deal for Luke Roy, and they were really pursuing Carlos Beltran to the end. So they could have had the biggest deadline of everybody, and you know, that might have helped obviously in game seven or something like that. But I think when you look at them this year, talking to people with the organization, their focus just was, quote, improving depth. That was their focus leading up. And on deadline day, you hear them link to Darvish and Britton and Brad Hand and maybe Sonny Gray a little bit. And you hear them all linked to those moves, and people's hopes get up that it'll be the second straight year. But that's, you know, the Indians have never been that big trade deadline buyer. And they, you know, it was an outlier in 2016 and kind of back to what we're used to in 2017. I always respect teams that are not willing to pay the big price. You know, Houston and Cleveland yesterday, kind of the teams that didn't do as much as you'd expect, but that's because the prices were extremely high. The prices on guys like Justin Wilson and Brad Hand and Zach Britton were exorbitant. You know, I think they were higher on Hand than anyone else because that year of control. Britton, there's a lot going on there with ownership in Baltimore meddling, but I think it's good when Cleveland, you know, sticks to their ground and says, you know, we're not willing to pay that price for these guys. It's not worth it. And so, especially a year after doing it for a reliever, you know, it's obviously worked out well for them because Miller's Miller, but, you know, I respect them, you know, standing tall and saying, we're not going to do that. So it's disappointing, I think, on a level for fans who wanted big moves for the second year in a row, but still, the obviously the big contender in the AL Central and one of the big contenders in the American League as a whole.
We are talking to Chris Cotillo about the Major League Baseball trade deadline. Jim Cushlin is with us as well. He's got something for you. Jimmy, go ahead.
You know, but staying in the Central Division, Chris, a lot of talk on what the Dodgers obviously did, and you mentioned the Astros and the Yankees and stuff. One team that isn't getting mentioned enough that I think had a fantastic, for them, trade deadline was the Kansas City Royals, who are streaking right now. Yeah, they lost yesterday, but they're still right behind the Indians at two games back. And the two moves that they made, one yesterday, one a few days ago, I look at the players they got. Those fill blatant needs. Trevor Cahill, well, Kansas City's always felt like they needed an extra starter. Brandon Maurer, Ryan Butcher, so they get help for the bullpen. And then you add Melky Cabrera from the fire sale White Sox. He could slide into Alex Gordon's spot because Alex Gordon completely looks over the hill. I hate to say it as an Indians fan, but I really love what Kansas City did in this deadline.
Yeah, it's you know, creative. I think getting Melky back is a move that a lot of people didn't know if he was actually going to move at all. And then the deal with the Padres was a creative one, too, being able to get, you know, those three pitchers that they did, Buckner, Maurer, and obviously Trevor Cahill for the rotation, and giving up Strom probably hurts. But they did fill all their needs, and they didn't get any of those big-time names. Obviously, Melky used to be a big name, but not too much anymore. They filled the needs they have and are going to be, you know, in the mix in that division. I think the Central showed some control that was, like, at the top three that was – probably more than any other division. I guess the AL West was pretty controlled in what they did too, but you know, none of the teams saw the other ones making big moves and thought, all right, we can just sit here and do what makes sense for us. You know, there's always that like brinksmanship situation with the Yankees and Red Sox. The Yankees make a move, the Red Sox have to react kind of thing, but in the Central, it wasn't like that. And again, I respect teams just filling their needs in ways that make sense for them.
And last thing, we'll let you run, Chris, because I know you're on a tight schedule. The defending champion Cubs, you know, they were in a bad way at the All-Star break. They came out of the All-Star break on fire, having figured things out for themselves, and then they improved. They got Justin Wilson and Avila in this deal that we talked about before. They got Quintana as well. So this is the team that got better, and they still might have a bit of a gap between themselves and the juggernaut looking, and I'll say looking because they don't always perform that way in the postseason, L.A. Dodgers. Do you think the defending champions have enough to get back?
They might. You know, they have those pieces that they've added. They shorten the game. Wilson's a great setup option in front of Wade Davis. That's an all-star as closer and a guy in Wilson who will slot into that role next year. You're looking at, you know, in the rotation, Lester, Arrieta, and Quintana at their best is pretty terrifying for other teams. And I think that's something that a lot of the clubs are going to fear. I think in the National League, any of those teams, you know, the Dodgers get all the headlines for being 43 games over 500 or whatever it is, but they have some staunch competition there. The Nationals are legit. The Cubs are legit. And we'll see. Arizona and Colorado in the wild card will be interesting to monitor as well.
Chris Cotillo, check him out at SBNation.com and the MLB page. Also check him out at MLBDailyDish.com, the site editor there as well. Chris, thanks for your analysis of everything at the trade deadline. We appreciate it. Looking forward to a great fall of baseball, and hopefully we can catch up again.
Sounds good. Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much, Chris. All right, Chris Cotillo is on a tight schedule. We got to let him go. But looking for your thoughts as well. Who are the winners and the losers at the trade deadline for you? I still feel, and he's right, by the way, Jim Cushlin, when he says that the expectations, I think, got up for Indians fans like you and like me.
Oh, sure.
To, you know, hey, they got Miller last year, and they were major players in the Beltran deal and in the Lucroy situation right up to it. And this year, you know, Darvish, his name is linked to the Indians in a possible trade. And then Sonny Gray's name is linked in a possible trade. And, you know, you start getting all of these fantastic ideas about even J.D. Martinez before he went to the
Indians had contacted the Tigers. That's right.
That's exactly right. So you get all of these expectations, and then you come away with, Joe Smith? That's it? That's all we got? Joe freaking Smith? Can't be that, you know, a righty. And again, not that Joe Smith is bad. You know, he's got an ERA of 3.20, I want to say, based on what I looked at yesterday. He has struck out 51 hitters in 38 innings pitched, which means he's doing his job when he gets in there in matchup situations and getting guys, especially if he comes in with guys on base and he needs punch outs. That's a pretty good ratio. But it's a righty and a righty-dominated bullpen that needed another lefty. So you just wonder, did they get enough, and were our expectations too high? If you're a guy like you and me who, you know, wants to see our team get back to the, you know, not only win the American League Central, but to go back to the show.
From the Indians, I think it's more of an expectations were too high from a fan's point of view. You know, you make the big splash last year. You were trying to be involved in other big splashes. Those didn't work out. And then the team... and those acquisitions take you to the seventh game World Series, or set a different way, to a 3-1 lead in the World Series before blowing it. So you would have expected them to be, you know, to do more maybe at the deadline. I think at the end of the day, most Indians fans would have been satisfied from a perspective of this past offseason because of the Edwin Encarnacion signing. I mean, how many years have we complained about, of Indians fans, I use the we, the proverbial we, complaining about Larry Dolan and the walk on his wallet, so to speak. But you lead up to this deadline, and there's two things at play here for the Indians. One, there's always the end of August, you know, the waiver deadline. Remember, that's where they picked up Coco Crisp
sure.
a season ago, and he was pretty darn valuable
yes,
in all
was.
Three playoff series. So there's still that. You never know what pops up on those. And two, is something that I keep going back to here and there when we have conversations like this. And especially when I'm looking at it through the prism of Indians v. Tigers. When you look up and down the Indians' current roster and where their contract statuses are, and not just the money, which is, you know, five guys next season for the Tigers will be making more than the highest paid Indian next year, which will be Encarnacion,
right.
Assuming, you know, Carlos Santana doesn't re-sign. You never know, but he's one of the couple of free agents. That's the side note there. There's not many free agents. But if you look up and down their entire roster, you'll see guys at lower contracts signed for multiple years. You know, even Andrew Miller, they picked part of the reason they were drawn to him, recall last year, not Aroldis Chapman, was the concept of, hey, we can keep Andrew Miller for two full seasons after this 2 month.
Kind of like the Yankees did with Sonny Gray here.
Precisely. So they're in an enviable position because most of the starting staff, good chunk of the bullpen, and bullpens are always reworked by every team seemingly every year, right? And position players, they're not just signed through next year. They're in many cases, they're signed for multiple years beyond this one. Recall Austin Jackson, Carlos Santana, Brian Shaw, and now you can add Joe Smith, are the only Indians who will be free agents this winter, Bob. And so there's a double-edged sword there. It's like, well, do we pick up guys and then, you know, somebody who's signed for a while, you know, may have to go to the back burner? It's part of the reason, you know, let's put it this way. Catcher is a position I would, in the long term, like to have them improve. And maybe they do that by, you know, bringing up the kid from who's still in Akron, I believe. I don't believe he's been called up to Columbus, Francisco Mejia, the prospect,
right.
The one who had the 50-game hitting streak. The gag is, believe it or not, the gag is, can you find somebody to take Yan Gomes' contract? Because in about 2 years, Yan Gomes gets paid $11 million. He sure hasn't been producing like he's worth $11
million. No.
But the point is, everybody on the Indians are signed and for multiple years, pretty much everybody, and relative to, say, the Tigers, on very good contracts. So there's not a lot, you know, that you really blatantly need. Or, and in terms of the positions you want to improve, well, don't forget, in terms of second base and outfield, in theory, over the course of next month, you're going to get Chisenhall, who's having almost a career year. I mean, let's call it what it is. Bloody Chisenhall's, even though he's on the deal right now, he's hitting 300, for goodness sake. I was getting to the point where I didn't think something like that was even possible out
he
of
was
him.
He was leading the team in RBIs
exactly.
Until he got hurt, too.
So you're also going to get those guys back, and, you know, fans hate hearing it, but GMs love to say it. Oh, that's almost like an acquisition right there. You know, but it's kind of true in a twisted way.
Yeah.
So the
if
Indians
he's been
are
out a long, if a guy's been out, here's the thing. If a guy who's a major part of your lineup has been out a long time and your team was winning without him, Then when he comes back, it's like you did. You picked up an extra bat, not a necessary bat. It's almost like, wow, we traded and improved ourselves by getting this new bat, this extra bat, this great hitter to join the guys that were already raking enough for us to be winning.
Right.
And they went on that winning streak without Kipnis and without Chisenhall. So if those guys come back and swing, and Chisenhall, as you pointed out, was Kipnis, not so much. But if they come back, it is like getting a couple of new offensive acquisitions
Correct.
To a team that was already performing.
And then the last part of all this, because all these things tie together in a way, are more or less statements that came out of the Indians over the course of the last week, which is like, look, we made our big splash that cost us big-time prospects trade last year. Andrew Miller, we're not going to trade our best prospects. And the Indians have a very good farm system right now. Or at least have some upper echelon guys that, like, say if you're a Tigers fan, you'd love to know those guys were in the pipeline. They don't have those guys right now. But, the you know, on certain levels, the Indians do have a few of those guys. And they've flat out said that we're not trading those big-name guys, which meant the likelihood of a big deal was pretty much out the door. Because it was going to cost you somebody. Like, I bet in any time they were calling in for Sonny Gray or Darvish again, we heard the little rumors that they were sort of involved. Yeah, I bet you Texas asked for Francisco Mejia, among others. And the Indians don't want to part with them right now. And I can't really blame them. They're still, as an overall roster and farm system, they're still in pretty good shape for beyond this year.
Yeah, I would completely agree. And that's the goal, of course, and that was always the problem. You know, when you are a middle market team, and Jim, let's look at that payroll again before we get to the bottom of the hour.
Okay.
When you're a middle market team spending as little as the Indians traditionally have, and you finally get the best of things, and you finally start winning, you want to make that last as long as you can, because you know that eventually you're going to have to pay guys that you cannot afford to pay.
Right.
Because you can't become Detroit. You would think that Cleveland and Detroit are very similar. You know, they're very close to one another geographically. They're very similar in their blue-collar nature.
And I think how they spend on their baseball teams in a couple years will be similar again.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You know, the populations of both cities are similar in terms of their middle-class economic, the lower middle-class economic backgrounds. So in terms of how much they can draw the gate, all those kinds of things are similar. And yet, here we are looking at their payrolls. And
I got it up right now, so let me know when you're ready to read off some numbers for you.
Because I want to read them, because I want to break them down.
Go ahead.
What I'm looking at is the MLB team payroll tracker for all facets of their payroll, meaning the Dodgers, for example, the most expensive payroll in baseball at $257 million. For their 25-man rotation.
Roster.
Or 20-man roster, excuse me, 25-man roster. $88.3 million. On the disabled, this is $110 million worth of players. $47 million retained, $12.7 million buried, all totaled in 2017. That's a $257 million payroll. Next highest is the Yankees, almost double the 25-man roster of the Dodgers, and way less on the disabled list, but $154, $19.6 on the disabled list, $47 million retained, $7 million considered to be buried, $222.
Okay.
I'll skip over the breakdown of the Red Sox, but they're at a total of $220. And then here come the Tigers, $205 million, $157 of which is on the 25-man roster. And, Jim, that's the very highest in all of baseball.
Yep. And we've gone over
this. Their 25-man roster, the Tigers are spending more than the Dodgers. They're spending more than the Yankees.
And we've
They're
gone
spending
over,
more than the Red Sox.
Yes, and we've gone over it many times, of course, but I'll remind everyone again, most of that active roster money is tied up in the following guys. Miggy. Verlander, Upton, Zimmerman, and...
Kinsler?
No, not Kinsler. Nope. He has an opt-out. I was thinking Victor Martinez, who still owed $18 million for next year.
There you go. That is another one. So the Tigers are sitting there with all of that payroll tied up in a lot of those guys you just mentioned who are virtually unmovable, even if you wanted to.
As we've all now learned more or less from Verlander in this trade deadline.
Yeah, exactly right. And they're sellers at the deadline. And really, I think, you know, we talked yesterday to who was our guest?
Ashley McLennan.
Ashley. And I think she was very optimistically saying maybe by the end of 2019, but probably more likely by the end of 2020 that they'd be contenders again. Until some of that dead money comes off of their payroll. I think it's going to be longer than that. They're at $205 million, $157 in active 25-man player contracts, 25-man roster contracts, I should say. Now, go down there and look at the Indians. You talked about whether or not they'll be good for years to come or for how long. They have the 19th highest payroll in baseball. They're spending $133 million, only 93 of which is in their active 25-man roster.
Twistedly, those numbers, if I'm not mistaken, represent the highest Indians payroll of all time,
ever.
By the way.
And it's 19th. They spend, the first-place team in the American League Central, spends less money than the Twins, who are fourth place in the Central. Third place ahead of the Tigers. Then the Rockies, they spend less than the Astros, which is really, talk about a bang for your buck, talking about the record. The Astros have at $139 million total payroll. They spend less than the Cardinals, less than the Royals, less than the atrocious Mets, less than the Mariners, less than the Angels of Anaheim, less than the Orioles, less than their counterparts in the World Series, the Cubs, who are up at $180 million, less than the Rangers, who are dead and buried, less than the Nats, the Giants, who are dead and buried, the Blue Jays, and then the aforementioned Tigers, mm-hmm. Red Sox, Yankees, and Dodgers at the top. The only teams, just for the sake of saying it, you could do it by process of elimination if you want, the only teams that spend less than the Indians this year, Marlins, Diamondbacks, Braves, Phillies, Reds, Pirates, White Sox, Rays, Padres, A's, and Brewers. So as you look at the big question there, which kind of launched me into this, and that is, you know, how long until the Tigers are able to be competitive again? You ask, how long can the Indians remain competitive, remain mm-hmm. contenders before, just like 1995, 96, 97, 98, hey, Albert's contract is up. Can we pay it? Nope. They just offered him $55 million, which was astronomical then, in Chicago. You know, Jim Thome, his contract is up. He said he wanted to stay, so let's put him to the test. Oh, he got another year from Philly. He's gone. Jim Thome is gone. You know, Kenny Lofton, we got to move him. We're not going to be able to pay him. Let's move him in the Marquise Grissom, David Justice deal. And on down the line we go. We can mm-hmm. go through it again and again. They cannot afford to pay
right.
the stars that make them contenders for the very short little bites at the apple. That's why last year hurt so much. It's why 1997 and the ninth inning against the Marlins hurt so much. Last year's 3-1 collapse hurt so much because it's so hard for a team whose payroll is at the highest it's ever been now, at 19th in baseball, and much, much more likely in 2018 and 2019 and 2020 to be down at the bottom rather than closer to the top or above the midpoint in baseball average salaries. You know, you kind of have to get it while the getting's good. Yep. They're not going to be able to re-sign everybody. They're not, I mean,
true.
You know, Lindor is locked up for a bit. Brantley is locked up for a bit. I don't have all of this memorized.
I got
course.
Some, and I was going to give a couple.
Kluber is locked up for a bit. Tell us where we are.
All right, basically, yeah, because to really illustrate the point, especially when I said a few minutes ago that I really love where the Indians are contract-wise going yeah. forward. Let's start with the highest paid guy, Edwin Encarnacion, 14.6 this year, 18.6 in 2018, 21.6 in 2019, club option for 2020. That's your highest paid guy. Jason Kipnis, 13.6 next year, 14.6 in 2019, also with a 2020 option. Andrew Miller, $9 million for next year. Brantley, he has a club option for 2018, which I know will be picked up. Then he'll be a free agent. You mentioned Kluber, $10 million next year, 13.2 after that, two club options in 2020 and 2021.
So he's locked up.
Ooh, we were talking about Chisenhall, who led the team in RBIs when he hit the disabled list a little bit ago. $4.3 million this year. He's got one more arbitration year left. Okay? What's another good one? Oh, here's a brilliant one. Jose Ramirez. He'll make 2.8 next year, 4.1 in 19, 6.6 in 20, 9.4 in 21, and then he has two option years, 2022 and 2023.
Club or player?
Those are club. Mostly in Bay. Usually in Bay. Here's a funny thing.
So he's locked up.
Yeah. Baseball, it's usually club options. I've noticed basketball, it's a lot of player options.
What about Carrasco?
Carlos Carrasco. Where'd he go? Okay, here's Carlos Carrasco. $8 million next year, two club options in 19-20.
Wow.
I mean,
they really are in a good position for
yes.
probably 3 years.
I would say minimum through 2019. Just looking at who they're at least
so through 2 years
through
minimum, but maybe for three with most of those guys.
Yes.
And because those are some pretty friendly club contracts, maybe they can open up the vault if that's what it takes to sell. Where, did you say Lindor? Where's Lindor?
Francisco Lindor is not even arbitration eligible until 2019.
Okay, so
he's making $579,000 this year, by the way.
When you talk about the guys who are most valuable, who are going to command the most money in the free agent market, because of a lot of these club-friendly contracts that you just described, they very well may be able to get into a bidding war for their own guy if it's the right guy. And I'm trying to figure out from that list which would be the next guy that you would expect to hit free agency after 2018 or 19 that is going to attract a ton of attention on the market. And whether or not they would be able to pay him, the chances.
Believe
are,
it or not, Carl Santana
he's not
probably
attract
will.
A ton.
I think Brian Shaw actually will. I could see a team out there in need of bullpen help saying, "Hey, Brian, we'll definitely pay you more than the $4.6 million you made this year, and we'll give you a chance to close." That's
which,
why
which,
I speak
by the
he's
way,
gone,
which by the way is ironic considering he's some of the Indians fans' favorite whipping boy.
Right.
You know, they blame him. He's not Miller and he's not Allen. And if he doesn't get everything done exactly the way they do, I mean, he really takes a lot of unfair criticism, in my opinion.
I think he does, too. He's a solid pitcher. He's not on Andrew Miller's level, but few are, right?
Yeah,
but
exactly.
The other thing, you know, real quick about some of these is, you know, another thing I noticed as I was reading through some of these contracts, it's like this new the guys in charge of the Indians right now, they for some of these big guys that we name, you know, Kipnis, where'd he go? Kipnis, not Chisenhall, but Jose Ramirez, these types of guys.
Yeah.
I look at them and I say, they're replaying what John Hart did 92, 93, 94, 95, which was try to sign a lot of those guys to more team-friendly deals before their free agency. Remember, you were talking about Bell and when he left free agency. Remember, at the same time, one of his big MOs as GM of the Indians in those days was, I'm going to sign these guys to longer-term deals, even though we're 4 years out from them becoming free agents. You look at some of those guys I named, like Jose Ramirez and Kipnis are some of the biggest examples. They replayed that same playbook, and now they're going to benefit from that because if Kipnis turns back into an all-star, he'll feel cheap at $14
million. Oh, heck yeah. No question. No, he absolutely would. That's I tell you what, Jim, we got to get a timeout here. Because it's 4:39 already, and I've got to remind everybody about some important things, including the Michigan International Speedway Contest we have got going up for you right now. If you want to go to the races at MIS coming up on the weekend of the 11th, here's what you got to do. Text the word MIS ticket, all one word, MIS for Michigan International Speedway ticket, to the number 64636, and you could win tickets to Friday qualifying, Saturday, NASCAR Camping World Truck Series. Sunday's Pure Michigan 400. That's the weekend of August 11th up at Michigan International Speedway. Text MIS ticket to 64636. Good luck from the Speedway and from Toledo's sports leader, ESPN 106.5, the ticket. Going to get a timeout here. Want to come back and talk a little bit more about the Major League Baseball trading deadline, some of the stuff we're talking about, who's poised to be good for how long, and how bad Tigers fans really kind of have to feel about the way things were managed. And you know what's weird, really odd, Jim? The president of baseball operations at the Boston Red Sox, a true contender right up there, of course, who beat the Indians last night for the American League East, Dave Dombrowski was responsible for a lot of the moves that were made as the Tigers built up that payroll to over 200 and some odd million dollars, fourth highest in baseball, all to get nothing to show for it except now selling off pieces and parts and going with the youth movement. So we're going to talk about how frustrating that part of this whole thing is as well. As we continue, it's ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, Toledo sports leader. That's us. I'm trying to remember what our catchphrase is, Toledo sports leader. I almost gave the extravaganza line. That's just this show right here on The Ticket. Back after this.
Now back to the Bob France extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Oh, my goodness gracious, what a crazy time it is baseball-wise. The rich get richer. The not-so-rich try to hang on and try to do the best they can. Jimmy, I didn't. What kind of a dividend do you think Smitty pays for the Indians downstream?
I think it'll be, you know, another effective...
The fan favorite, by the way.
Yeah, I think it'll be another effective, you know, reliever. I'm curious to see how Terry Francona uses him, because forget the lefty-righty thing. You now got four guys who are pretty solid that you can use in tied and winning situations, because, you know, it's usually a different set of guys if you're losing. That's how managers are. Right. You have four guys. Forget the lefty-righty thing. You have four guys that you can use in tied or winning situations. What it really does is lighten the load more than anything on Shaw, who was right there at the tip-top of reliever innings and games appeared in again this season. You know, Miller as well. It helps ease the burden these last couple of months on those guys. And I think it's going to be – I think it's a pretty solid move for a guy who, yes, will be a two-month rental. He's a free agent, which is why now the Indians technically have four guys who will be free agents after this year, not just three. And they didn't have to give up much of anything to get him. And – again, lefty-righty aside, you're strengthening what is arguably, and statistically it is, the best bullpen in baseball.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt. They really, I mean, it's hurt by the matchup thing with the righty-lefty thing. It really is. There's no question about that. But having said that, when you add that kind of a quality, really, or quality arm, no matter which side it comes from, to the quality that's there, when you really do have some of the best relievers in baseball, it can only help. I still think I would love to have had that lefty. And you know what? We've seen the non-waiver trades made before, the waiver trades before, I should say, you know, like Coco Crisp, as you brought up. Maybe there is still something that can be done before they get into the postseason, if indeed they are successful in getting there.
And I think they're still going to be looking. I mean, at this point in time, especially if the subject is lefty reliever, I very much expect them to make one more small move before the August 31st waiver deadline. I absolutely do at this point.
I do too. The waiver deadline is, of course, what I'm speaking of. So yeah, I completely agree. Hey, I want to get into a couple of other things before we're done, Kush, because we started talking about a little bit about this at the top of the show, but didn't spend a lot of time on it. We have all heard, I assume, LeVar Ball's misogynistic rant against the female official at the AAU game. This is now not just a one-time thing. This is a habit. It starts to become a habit. We know that LeVar Ball, the father of NBA second overall pick Lonzo Ball, who's of course now with the Lakers and expected to be, you know, a phenomenal talent, maybe the centerpiece of the Lakers that would draw a bigger centerpiece like LeBron James to the Lakers a year from now, a summer from now. But LeVar Ball, we know that he is one great, big, giant marketing tool. He uses himself, and he will put himself out there. He'll embarrass himself, do whatever it takes to get attention for big baller brand. He'll make outlandish claims like, I could beat Michael Jordan on one-on-one in my prime, in his prime. I could beat him one-on-one now in my older age, in his older age. Same thing, get into messes with Charles Barkley, gets into fights with Shaquille O'Neal, gets into fights with Stephen A. Smith, all to promote his big baller brand. And we want $2 billion, no, $3 billion for any shoe company to sign the rights to my three boys because they're worth every bit of it, blah, blah, blah. We know that. But we're getting into a territory where I kind of agree with Jay Billis of ESPN, who has said, this is enough. This is enough attention being paid to this attention whore. And that's exactly what he is. He is an attention whore. He's willing to sell himself out for publicity. That's exactly what an attention whore does, even if it means being controversial to the point of hurting other people. Jay Billis has reached his limit, and he wrote a very, very thoughtful column this week, which kind of summarizes my views as well. You notice I've not been very fond, even though he's kind of funny from time to time, fond of LeVar Ball's style and what he is doing. When he visited a Fox Sports television/radio show last month, actually I think it was toward the end of June, he only talked to the male host of the show. The female co-host of the show, he refused to look at her, refused to speak to her directly, and told her to stay in her lane, as if to say, you don't belong up here with the big boys. You don't belong up here with the boys. You don't get to have an opinion on this subject. In part, it was perceived in the way he presented it because you're a girl. You don't get sports. Stay in your lane. That's what he told her. It was incredibly rude. It was incredibly sexist. It was misogynistic. But some might have again said the dude is just doing what the dude does, drawing attention to himself. But I don't think that that's okay anymore. First, let me go back. Here's what Billis wrote in this very very good article that I enjoyed. To whatever extent I enjoyed LeVar Ball and his antics at first, I now find him close to intolerable. Instead of being in on the joke, he has become the joke, and it's no longer funny. He started to lose me when he publicly complained about his son's high school coach, who was ultimately out of his job. Then he told Fox Sports' Christine Leahy, that's the story I was just talking about, to stay in her lane, which I found to be disrespectful and unnecessary to the point of being misogynistic. Then he started to show himself through his participation as a grassroots summer basketball coach. He is needlessly profane, and his conduct is out of control with officials, and he's not worthy of being in charge of the development of young players. Well, then, when he finally told another woman the same thing he told Christine Leahy, to stay in her lane, that was just about enough. USA Today Sports reported it. In explaining his frustration after being tossed by a female referee at his son's AAU game, he told ESPN that the female referee had a vendetta and needs to stay in her lane because she ain't ready for this. He went on to say, she's a woman who's trying to act. I get that she's trying to break into the referee thing, but just giving texts and calling fouls, that's no way to do it. I know what she's trying to say. I gave LeVar, I gave him a tech. I'm strong. That ain't got nothing to do with it. Just call the game. He went on to say that she was out of shape, which is baloney because I saw her. She is not out of shape. We have seen, I have seen. Jim Cushlin, you have probably seen. Hell, you might represent referees who maybe are not exactly in the best shape. I have seen it. I know if I was on a court right now running up and down, people would say, that dude can't make the call. How could he? He couldn't get into the right position. Maybe get in shape so you can make it down the court faster. And I've been a coach, and I've thought that. Get your rotund butt down the court so that you can be in position to make the call. And it's not about body shaming or any of that nonsense. It's about literally, if you can't get down there in time to be in a position
right.
to see whether it was a charge or a block or whether it was a foul or not, whether it was ball or whether there was body, if you can't move down there, you got no business doing this. Right,
because then you're not in the correct position to make the call. That's just normal officiating 101
right there. If what he said about this woman was true, then you know what, she's not in shape to do this, and that was the case. Okay, maybe there's something to that. But I saw her.
Yeah.
She's in far better shape than you or me or a whole lot of other people I know.
Oh, yeah.
She was perfectly capable of refereeing that game.
No question.
But he used this line, stay in your lane, now twice on two different women publicly, which pretty much says this guy has no respect for women. This guy has no respect whatsoever for women in a position of authority, in a position of power, in a position of high publicity. He talked down to Christine Leahy on that Fox Sports show. Now he calls out this woman referee for being a female, saying she trying to act strong like I gave LeVar a tech, as if that's all she has to do to gain credibility in the officiating world is tee up an obnoxious jerk like this. It's getting borderline dangerous. You know, in terms of his treatment of people and his treatment of his victimizing of people like these women.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to Jay Billis, I just want to read one last quote here. Because, what's the old adage? If somebody has already said it better than you, don't try to outdo it. Just quote them. And I think that's what Billis does here. He used stay in her lane twice. Quote, well, LeVar Ball lost me on that one. Not that he cares or should care, but I'm done with him, writes Jay Billis. I'm done listening to him, consuming his nonsense, or caring what he has to say. If he apologizes to the women that he has insulted and changes his bizarre behavior, I can certainly change my mind. But absent that, I will no longer laugh at the behavior of LeVar Ball, nor will I participate in the coverage of his prattle and his hot air. It is not worthy of our coverage and not funny at all anymore. I was wrong about LeVar Ball. He's not a Kardashian. That's far too kind. He's a misogynistic buffoon, unworthy of my time. Again, if I can't say it better, quote somebody else who said it.
No question.
That's what Jay Billis said, and I completely agree. The sad thing is, Kush, his son is going to be a superstar.
Yep.
And his son's play on the court, whether it's positive and he has a triple-double in the NBA this season as rookie year, or if he has a 2-for-15 and 6 points and 2 assists and fouls out. Dad is going to make headlines. Dad is going to be heard because Dad wants to be heard, and most of the media won't have the guts to do what Jay Billis is doing.
Yeah.
Most of the media won't have the guts to do what I am pledging to do, and that is not give him my time. It's one of the reasons I said if I was a GM and I had two guys that were very close to one another on my board, I would draft the other guy and stay away from Lonzo Ball. Sadly, I also said that I would root against Lonzo Ball. I would be a hater, if you will, rather than root for this guy to be successful because it would only prove his father right. I'm back in that place now. It's not Lonzo's fault, but I don't want to see Lonzo because then it means I'm going to have to see LeVar. And like Jay Billis, I've had enough of this woman-hating, self-marketing, self-promoting, buffoonish cartoon character. I've just had enough.
Yeah.
That's where we're going to have to leave it, Kush. Sorry about that. It was a long, extended monologue there to end the show, but I just really wanted to get all of that out. Okay, that is all the time that we got. Hey, on the way out the door, I did this for you yesterday. I'm going to do it again. You up for a $100 gift certificate to Vapor's Electronic Smoke Shop on Monroe? If you are, I've got one for you. Be the fifth caller right now to 866-240-1065, and we will set you up with those gift certificates, with that gift certificate. They are good through August 31st. So good luck to you. Stay where you are. Drive Time is coming up next right here on The Ticket.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.